Welcome to the Market Moment. My name is Matt Walters, here with Lee Mackey and a kind of a guest now.
Yeah, pretty
David
much.
Lee. David's not on the podcast very much anymore. It used to be a weekly thing for you, yep. But yeah, glad to have you on the show this week.
Great to be here.
So kind of just jumping into it. So David, you know, founder of Mach 1, author, last year published his first book. So that's exciting. So today we're going to talk some about that as well as a few other topics. But since we have David here with us, going to talk about the connection between demographics, market performance, the expectations versus reality in the stock market, and how much is truly in our control. So specifically kind of setting David up for some points that you make in the book, and I've heard you talk a lot about demographics and the impact that has on the markets and the economy. But you wrote in your book, Mission Focused, Purpose Driven, about a huge change in perspective, how you saw a pattern in birth rates in the economy. And I know you've read a couple books and learned about this from a few people, but the U.S. economy is consumer driven. And if there are more consumers purchasing and selling goods than the economy, then there's more economic activity. So statistically speaking, people spend more in their lifetime when they're in their 45 to 55 year old age range. So can you kind of just run with that, kind of explain what the thoughts behind the demographics and the impact that has on the U.S. economy?
Yeah, I talk about it a lot in the book, as you said. And as you also said, I mean, I can't take credit for the idea. I read it from when I was first getting into this business after a career in the Air Force as a fighter pilot. I had to read everything I could get my hands on to try to learn about, to try to figure out what does drive an economy and by extension, markets and stock markets, mm-hmm. right? And so I read a book. After reading many books, I came across one by a guy named Harry Dent. He's a Harvard-trained economist. And he laid out a case for why demographics, specifically birth rate trends, are kind of probably the key predictor of whether a nation's economy is going to be kind of in a boom cycle or a bust cycle. And he kind of essentially, in my opinion, proved the point by showing what the U.S. economy did after the baby boom. Mm-hmm. We all know the story of the baby boom, 1944, 45, soldiers come home from war. And a
lot of babies.
A lot of babies get produced. Yep. And so birth rates, we basically had the baby boom from 1945 to 1962. And as you said in your intro there, you know,
most consumers people spend money in the 45 to 55 year old.
And it makes sense. I mean, for anybody out there listening, if you're in your mid-40s to mid-50s, you know exactly what we're talking about, right? Your kids are at that stage of life where they're the most expensive. They're in college maybe. And, you know, whereas if you're 20 years old and maybe single or 20 years old, newly married, your living expenses aren't nearly as much as if you've got two or three kids in college, right? And then after the kids get out of college or get out of high school or whatever it is they do and get join the workforce and you become an empty nester, naturally your household spending declines again. Mm-hmm. So for a variety of reasons, spending peaks in the mid-40s to mid-50s for the average American. So it doesn't take a genius to figure out that, well, if 70% of our economy, our GDP, is consumer spending based, if the peak spending demographic group is growing in numbers due to birth rate trends that occurred 45 to 50 years ago, you're probably going to have a growing economy today. And he kind of proved that by overlaying a plot of the birth rate, essentially, mm-hmm. with overlaid with like the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones Industrial Average on a 45-year lag. And it was amazing how highly correlated the two plots were.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as a result, you know, back in 2005, 2006, 2007, which were my first 2-3 years in this business, I was warning all of our clients back then, hey, I think we've got a major crash or correction coming due to birth rates peaking in 1962 on a 45-year lag. That's 2007. Sure enough, 2008, we all remember that major market crash. And then we had the longest recovery from a recession in our lifetimes after the 2008 bust. And I believe that is a major cause of that was simply demographic forces, right? From 1962 to 1973, birth rates declined every year over year. So from 2007 to basically 2018, due to birth rate trends, it was pretty predictable that we were going to have a recession, and it ended up, you know,
coming true. It can give you an idea of like, hey, there's going to be some pressure from a spending perspective. You don't necessarily know where that's going to come from.
That's correct.
But you can get an idea of, hey, there's going to be fewer people spending, you know, less money. And so somewhere, you know, asset prices are going to be impacted.
That's right. Because
people aren't spending as much or don't have as much money to spend. And so, yeah, I think it's a good kind of big picture perspective to look at. And then you try to dive into, okay, maybe where will we see that play out? Because each cycle could be different.
Absolutely. Maybe it's impacted. We all know, and you out there listening, you know, there is no crystal ball. There is no single factor that you can look at, even demographics, that you can say, well, we're going to have a great economy during this period of time and a bust economy during this period of time.
Right.
Because economies are complex. And, you know, this is just looking at U.S. birth trends and U.S. GDP. We're a global economy, so that plays into it. We've got immigration. That's a topic in the news all the time. That plays into it. So there are other factors, but I do think that birth trends. Elon Musk happens to agree with me.
Yeah.
I've got articles here we can talk
about.
Have
more babies.
Yeah. I mean, Elon Musk is out there saying, hey, the declining birth rate trend that we're seeing is going to be is going to cause civilization to crumble. And again, I would say it doesn't take a genius to figure that out either.
Right? You know,
it takes people to run the world.
You know, a couple weeks ago, I don't know if I was watching Bloomberg Finance or one of the business channels, but they were talking about how in China, their birth rate continues to decline, and they are worried
in Japan too
about the future.
Yes,
you know, of the Chinese economy that you know
they don't have enough workers.
Yeah, and they're talking about how for the first time maybe it dropped below two or I don't know, one and a
right.
half.
It's
I
like mean, it's, one and a half.
Yeah, yeah, one and a half. That for the articles. First time ever that you know there is a genuine concern that you know 30, 40 years from now, you know, what does the China economy look like?
Yeah. And those are great examples. I mean, you've got Japan and China. You know, where birth rates have been low, and you had China,
time.
You had the one child policy.
That's right.
Now they, you know, they're just now, I think, well, I'm not saying just now, but they're realizing the impact
That's
of that
exactly
from
right.
an economic perspective. You know, when you try to manipulate something like that, it has lasting consequences.
That's right. And on the note of Japan, I mean, some of you out there listening may remember back in the, I want to say, maybe the early 90s, there was a lot of concern that Japan was going to kind of become the world economic power. I don't know if you guys remember that.
Yeah,
they were
sure.
buying up property left and right in the United States. And then what ended up coming back to bite them was this demographic thing.
Mm-hmm.
Their population, they weren't having enough children years and years ago. And so their population of young people just dramatically declined. And that's why Japan has kind of been in a rut economically for quite some time. It's very much demographically related.
You know, I'm looking here. I'm maybe cheating and looking ahead on our notes, but interesting that, you know, some people think that as a country's GDP rises, as a country becomes more economically sound, that the birth rate actually begins to drop.
And it does.
And I don't know off the top of my head, in the U.S., is our birth rate dropping?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It is.
In fact, a lot of some of the articles here that I was reading preparing for this talked about how a lot of experts, y'all will remember this, during the COVID pandemic, a lot of people thought, well, hey, with people being stuck at home, we're going to see a baby boom as a result. And it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And we were already kind of seeing ever since about 1992. If I'm not mistaken, birth rates have been declining again. So we had the baby boom, 45 to 62, baby bust, 62 to 73, echo boom, 73 to 92, and then birth rates kind of declining again after that. And so we'd been kind of in a long, slow decline, and experts that monitor this stuff were hoping we were going to see kind of a baby boom from COVID, and it didn't happen.
Hmm.
And so, yeah, I think – you know, down the road, we're going to have potentially some economic issues as a result. But if I could go back to your original question, though, you're right. Birth rates do tend to decline as a country gets wealthier. You know, people tend to have fewer children. They tend to invest more in those children's college educations and things like that.
And we know what the cost of education is doing. And so in my mind, I'm just kind of speculating, you know, as inflation, you know, we had COVID, but then we had, you know, hyperinflation, you know, for a period of time. And I wonder if that kind of played into the fact of, like, you know, we can't afford
to bring more children into the world. That plays into it. These articles talk about that too, how, you know, during tough economic times, people don't have as many children because they feel like they can't afford them.
Interesting.
And we'll throw some of those links to the
absolutely. We'll
link show notes,
into the show notes.
That way people can, you know, click on that. And I was pulling up while you guys were talking, I was looking at Y charts here, just pulling up. So, like, Japan's real GDP versus U.S. real GDP since 1994 is when this goes back to. And the, you know, Y chart shows U.S. real GDP is up over 107% over that time period. You know, Japan's real GDP has grown at 25% over that exact same time period. So, yeah, that can explain a lot.
There's,
it's also why, you
there's
know,
a lot
I mean,
to it.
Japanese stock market's been pretty
struggling
tough, long time.
And I will say, it's always dangerous making a public prediction on a podcast that's available to the public.
Yeah, we'll archive this. Or as they say, mark the tape.
That's right.
The commenters will.
But if you just looked at demographics alone, and we've already stated you can't use any one single factor. If you just looked at demographics alone, you would predict that the U.S. economy, and therefore, you know, by extension, the U.S. stock market, should be generally trending up and to the right through the late 2030s or so, maybe even early 2040s, if you just based it off of demographics alone. And again, that's based on the fact that we had the echo boom that lasted till 1992. Well, what's 1992 plus 50? It's 2042. Or if you do plus 45, it's 2037. So just based on that factor alone, you would predict late 2030s to early 2040s. So we'll see. Doesn't mean we won't have a recession in between now and then. But it means that if we do have the inevitable, I would even argue, healthy recession, it should be relatively short-lived, nothing like the long recession that we had post-2008 crash.
Interesting.
Well, and real quick on that, so that obviously has impacted a lot of kind of how you see the economy and the markets, and but it's also impacted how we do things here at Mach 1. You know, from a charitable perspective, you know, we're very we pride ourselves in being very charitably minded and giving back. And, you know, a lot of that has to do with obviously our faith and what we're, you know, what we feel called and told to do in scripture. And so that's directly impacted how we try to give back as a firm. So explain a little bit about how those two things have kind of come together, our charitable focus and everything you just kind of laid out.
So, in the book, here's the book plug. Mission focused, purpose driven. I talk a lot about that. I talk about the demographic stuff we talked about. And so, you know, the title, mission focused, purpose driven, our mission at Mach 1, y'all probably talked about it on the podcast in the past, is to basically help our clients, help you achieve your financial goals and dreams, right? Whether that be for retirement or traveling or whatever it may be. That's basically our mission in life, right? Is to help our clients achieve what they're trying to achieve financially. But what's the higher purpose behind it? What, you know, why do we do what we do, and how can we have an impact on the world, hopefully, that will outlive us and outlive Mach 1? We believe, based on what we just talked about, that whole demographic thing, that if we can somehow influence the next generation, if we can reach the next generation, you can change your country morally, financially, you know, economically. And so as a result, we've chosen to partner with what we term Christ-centered, next-generation-focused charities that basically start pre-birth through high school. So like Loving Choices, we partner with them. We donate money to them every year and serve alongside them in certain events during the year. And it's simply an organization that helps the expectant mother make that loving choice to carry the child to birth, as opposed to, you know, having an abortion or something. And not only does it help her make that choice, but also helps support her after birth, to so that you're not just like, okay, good job, good choice, you carried the child, now good luck raising him or her, right? So they help support that mother as well. And then we support The Call, which you're familiar with, Matt. They're a foster care agency that helps come alongside families who've made the choice to help take a child who's in the foster care system and provide a home and provide all the resources for them. I think that's going to be more important as states like Arkansas, for example, where it's illegal actually to have an abortion now. Organizations like The Call is going to become even more important, so we partner with them as well. Northwest Arkansas Children's Shelter, we support them as well. CFAC, the which Lee is on the board of CFAC, Child Family and Advocacy Center. And so, you know, that's also an organization that is supporting the next generation. And then Fellowship of Christian Athletes, or FCA, which is one of the last avenues to get the gospel of Christ into schools. So we've been very strategic in
what our higher purpose. Yeah, a lot of intentionality behind who, you know, who we're choosing to partner with, obviously for the ultimate goal of, you know, impacting those children and their families, you know, spiritually, but also the trickle-down effect that it can have, you know, economically, financially. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of benefits to that. So it's been really cool to do that, and that all, it all kind of goes back to your roots of reading that book.
Yeah, it really does.
I mean, that's really where it all started.
That's right.
It's been kind of, it's been really cool to see what that's led to and how that's kind of helped focus our trajectory and focus on the charitable side of things. So, yeah, really good conversation. So encourage all, you know, all the listeners out there, dive into that some and you know, give us your feedback on what you think. And like David said, there's not any one thing that you can use to predict the future, whether that's economically or what the stock market's going to do. But I think this is a really interesting thing that you can use to help, you know, build that overall picture of what you expect over the coming years. So, okay, so hard pivot from that. We're going to we're gonna jump into, you know, investment expectations. This is a conversation I feel like I'm having a lot. It's, I would venture to say even a lot, like lately specifically. I think you maybe tend to have it more when the market's really strong, or you're coming off of a good year or two, you know, with the indexes performing really well. And that's just, you know, investor expectations. Like, what should investors, and when I say investors, we're investors, right? So I'm speaking about ourselves too. We're not out of this group of people, but what investors should expect and how they should, you know, benchmark their, you know, their returns and their expectations moving forward. So kind of what I mean by this is, you know, the natural tendency for everybody is the S&P 500, right? Yeah. We talked about it a couple weeks ago. It's the one major index that you can turn on any news channel, and that is the primary index people are looking at. It's probably the best index when you're looking at just the overall U.S. stock market, right? It's the 500 largest companies. And so that's what people are looking at. And so a lot of people, when they see this, that particular index have a really good year or a really good run, they're like, well, I should be doing that. And they kind of lose sight in the, often of what are their goals? What are they trying to accomplish? What are they comfortable with from a risk perspective? And it just very quickly gets into, well, I should get that. That's what the market's doing. So Lee, kind of what are your initial thoughts or comments on that?
I mean, it's just what you said. You know, before you said the S&P 500, I think that is the most common benchmark. Or, you know, oftentimes you'll just hear what the markets are doing. You'll hear that in general. Well, the markets were up X percent. So many things go into it. Like you said, risk tolerance and their objectives and, you know, their time horizon, blah, 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 blah. You know, I think another thing that impacts it, that you get this disconnect between reality and expectations is talking to your neighbor, your coworker. That was the first thing.
Your golfing buddy.
Your golfing buddy. Yeah. I mean, you talk to a couple guys and they're like, oh, I was up 30% last year.
I think there's a lot of that.
And then in their mind, they're like, well, I didn't get 30%.
Yeah.
You know, and to me, the water cooler talk is almost just as dangerous, if not more so,
100%.
Than just looking at an index because we all do it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, how many times have we had clients, great clients, come to us who otherwise would be happy, but they're referencing something their golfing buddy said?
You know, there's a saying that says comparison. Well, you might have to edit this out because now all of a sudden I've forgotten.
That quote.
Comparison breeds discontent.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
Comparison breeds discontent. And that's very true.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it is. And so, so much of our job, and we've talked about this, you know, when we go to conferences, some of the conferences I've attended, there's more and more sessions on the psychology of investing,
yes.
Not the X's and O's and yeah. What to invest. It's the psychology, and it's managing those expectations. And it's not like we're trying to temper expectations. It's just, it's managing them
yes.
To keep clients, you know, in check with their risk tolerance, well, and their investment objectives.
I feel like so often investing in general is oversimplified. And
yes.
I think there's a truth to that, in that the access to, and this is a great thing, this is all positive, so I'm not trying to pitch this as a negative, the access to investing, the cost to invest, all of those things, of the barrier to access and entry is way to, you know,
sure.
Much lower than it used to be. And so in that light, it is easy. The extremely difficult part that I would venture to, that I would make an argument, is more difficult now than it probably was 20 years ago, when accessing investments was more difficult, making investments, is the psychological component to investing. And that is the part that is easily discounted. And it's, I think, even discounted more so when things are going really well with the indexes. And so investing is really stinking hard.
Mm-hmm.
It is. And a big component of that is keeping yourself in check with
yes.
What are your goals, what are your expectations, what should be your expectations, and staying the course and not making irrational decisions at the wrong time. And that is a very complicated and hard thing to do consistently over time.
You know, I'll add two quick things, but you know, there have been so many instances where I've met with somebody whether it's in my office or, you know, on a golf course, or, you know, they're like, hey, can you get me 12%, 15%.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, the answer is yes, but then I'm going to follow that up with, do you have the stomach in order to,
50%. Yeah.
to deal with all the ups and downs that is going to be required?
That's right.
That's typically going to be, the answer is no.
And but you then, know what the answer, what I've found the answer usually is in good times? Oh, yeah, I've got the stomach to deal with that.
Well, and
you know what happens when it actually hits?
Yeah.
They don't.
Yeah.
Now, some people do. The truth is, most people don't.
And when you say they, I yeah. would put, you know, that's true for ourselves.
Sure,
I
absolutely. Think.
And that's why we have
people,
like,
people in general.
That's why we have, like, at the firm, you know, we have an investment committee, a team of advisors and team of people outside the firm that we consult with. And because any one person, myself included, you put yourself in a box and you try to make rational, good decisions when things get difficult, right? You're much less likely to make good decisions than when you surround yourself with a team of advisors or consultants and people that you trust. And so that is, I think it's a good reminder now, when, you know, the coming out of a year, the market's been good last year. It's been pretty good to start the year, right? The indexes are up. I think now, instead of waiting till something bad happens, now's a really good time to be reminding yourself of, this is really hard, and you don't want to think things are too good to be, you know, and going to stay that way forever. Make sure you understand what risk you're comfortable with. Surround yourself with a team of advisors, you know. And when I say advisors, that could be your spouse,
sure,
your friends that can help hold you accountable, or it could be a team of actual professional advisors that are going to help you get through those situations where it can be really easy to make knee-jerk reactions, and you can blow yourself up quickly financially.
Well, and it, you know, it's not just in the good times. It's also the down. I mean, that when we're just kind of meandering along, that's when it's not that difficult. But
it's the extremes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, and one of the bullet points we have on here is, you know, what's a healthy investing mindset? That is our job, truly, to manage that within the client.
Yeah.
And that's why we do those risk profile questionnaires. That's why we circle back and look back to original comments and conversations, because it's easy to get caught up in, oh my gosh, buy me NVIDIA because it's up 300%. You know, well, does that fit in with what you're trying to achieve?
Yeah.
Maybe it does, but
often it doesn't.
And it's also true on the downside. You know, so many people in a market that's down significantly want to bail, or they want to go do something that their buddy told them about. Well, again,
I'll give you a perfect, very recent example, and you guys will relate to this. Not too long ago, like a year ago, markets were not doing well. But what was doing good? Fixed interest rates, right? Yep. The Fed had just raised rates. We're getting 5% interest on money markets. And so what were, you know, decent.
A lot of people, that was easy a lot of people to were say, saying, I'll take it.
Why would I take all this risk in the market when I can get 5% in money market? I mean, we had lots of people, right?
Yeah.
Thinking, well, I should just be in my, and now what are people thinking?
Yeah.
Why am I not getting S&P 500?
Yeah, get me out of this CD.
And so it's a great example of, your cash, by all means, go get 5%.
Yeah.
But like your long-term investment dollars, like don't get into the game
That's
of,
right.
hey, I'm gonna get 5% while I can. Like, you know, have the long-term plan.
Yeah.
Have a sequence of reviewing that and adjusting it as needed. But it's a good reminder for all of us that investing is really hard.
Yeah.
And it can be very emotional, and it can be very easy to make, you know, irrational decisions at the worst possible times. And so, just be aware of that, and then surround yourself with people and processes and systems that can help you avoid making bad decisions.
You know, I had a lady in my office last week, and, you know, we were talking, and she said, so ultimately your job is to what? And I said, we take the emotion out of
investing.
And I think that kind of sounded cold when I said it, but I said, truly, that is.
I think that's a big part of an advisor's job, is to help the client take the emotion out of investing.
I mean, we're as much, any advisor, any good advisor, is every bit as much, if not more so, of just like a coach.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Than they are like.
Psychologist.
We should buy this or that. That's a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But a good advisor should be a really good just coach and coaching you through the ups and downs.
Our process, for those of you that are clients, you know this. I mean, there's a reason why we do that retirement analyzer program, and we refer back to it constantly because we're trying to use that to remind our clients, you don't necessarily need a 15% return or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, if you most of our clients, if they average somewhere between, and it varies. Some clients need a 0% rate of return and they'll be fine. Some clients might need a 6-7% rate of return or so and they'll be fine. But almost nobody needs a 10-12% rate of return. I mean, we can get that, like you said earlier, but at what level of risk?
And even though everybody wants that, most people, myself included, in some ways, like, aren't comfortable with the risk required. Like, I would rather get a slightly lower return with some stability than just trying to knock the cover off the ball every year after year. So, I don't want to, you know, chase that too far. But I think it's a really good conversation, a good reminder for us. We talk about these things internally all the time, so I wanted to just kind of bring it up here
and good topic.
Kind of remind everybody.
Probably a good note to end we need to end this segment. There's a really good book. We talked a lot about psychology and how it relates to investing. There's a really good book called The Psychology of Money.
Yeah.
Maybe we can put that in the show notes. Maybe let's put that in the show notes also. Good. It's a good read that we would recommend to listeners.
Yeah, for sure. So we're going to tie things up for the sake of time. Good conversation today, David.
Good to have
you. Yeah, yeah. We should
do this more often.
Yeah,
yeah. We'll watch it back and see if we're going to invite you back or not. But no, it was fun having you. As always, we appreciate you guys listening. Give us a like and a subscribe. Share the YouTube videos. Any videos that you're watching, we'd appreciate your help sharing those on your social media platforms. And check out our YouTube channel, trying to put out a lot of content these days. So really having a lot of fun with that. So as always, we want to end with something. When I say as always, I usually ignore Zoe's dad jokes. But this one was pretty good, so I am going to actually read it. This one says, why are Irish bankers successful? It says, because their capital's always doubling.
It's good.
Yeah. Hopefully somebody got a chuckle out of that.
Dublin.
All right. Appreciate you guys watching. We'll see you next week.
The hosts of this show are employees of Mach 1 Financial Group. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and nothing said in the show should be taken as investment advice. Mach 1 Financial Group, LLC, is an SEC registered investment advisor located in Rogers, Arkansas. Mach 1 may only transact business in those states in which it maintains a notice filing or qualifies for an exemption or exclusion from registration requirements. SEC registration does not constitute an endorsement of the firm by the commission, nor does it indicate that the advisor has attained a particular level of skill or ability. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. all investment strategies have the potential for profit or loss. The information presented is the sole opinion of the speaker and is not meant to be investment advice. Mach 1 does not provide tax or legal advice. You should speak to your tax or legal advisor regarding your specific situation. For full disclosures, click on the link in the episode description below.